Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of The Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Rachel Carson, a hugely influential marine biologist and nature writer. Her 1962 book, Silent Spring, is perhaps her most recognized work, as it led to a nationwide ban on DDT and other pesticides, and sparked the worldwide environmental and conservation movements. The Library of America recently released a collection of Carson's Sea Trilogy, three books that poetically depict life in the world's oceans. We're joined today by the editor of that collection, Dr. Sandra Steingraber. Dr. Steingraber is an ecologist, author, cancer survivor, and an internationally recognized authority on the environmental links to cancer and human health. Her acclaimed book, Living Downstream, an ecologist's personal investigation of cancer and the environment, was adapted into a documentary film in 2010. She has also written Having Faith, an ecologist's journey to motherhood, and Raising Elijah, protecting our children in an age of environmental crisis. Heralded as the new Rachel Carson, she speaks extensively and serves as a senior scientist for the Science and Environmental Health Network, where she researches and writes about the risks and harms of oil and gas extraction. Dr. Steingraber is interviewed by Nate King, Content and Communications Coordinator for the American Writers Museum.
Well, thank you for being here with me today, Dr. Steingraber.
Thanks for having me, Nate.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I have been reading Rachel Carson's work quite a bit these last couple of weeks, and but excited to get to talk to you about that. But first, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I'm a PhD biologist who really labors in the vineyards that Rachel Carson planted, if you will. Like Rachel Carson, I studied both biology and English literature as an undergraduate, and then went on to get advanced degrees in both things. And so I would say I share with Carson a belief that what biology and poetry have in common is that both are concerned about the mystery of being alive, but whereas biology wants to solve that mystery, poetry kind of says, behold. So I see in Carson's writing both that kind of reverence and impulse to behold the natural world and feel connection within it, but then also that sort of scientist's eye that really wants to understand the molecular mechanisms by which this whole beautiful web of life actually operates as a kind of machine. And there's intense beauty in that for me, as there is for Carson. And the other thing that I share, a couple other things I think in common with Carson, both of us are queer women, and both of us had a cancer diagnosis. The difference being that I, at this moment in history, am able to say publicly with you right now that that's part of my identity and it informs my science. I think having a queer eye for the natural world as a scientist is really important. And so I'm part of a whole queer and STEM collective, right? In a way that Carson was, of course, in one generation ago, was forced to keep that very secretive, as well as she lived in a time when her own breast cancer diagnosis, she was dying the whole time she was writing her book, Silent Spring, and had many women in her household helping her in the end actually transcribe what she was saying, because her she had so many tumors in her vertebrae, she couldn't type anymore. And so that part of her life had to be kept in really secretive, because she feared that her enemies in the chemical industry would use the facts of her autobiography to impeach her science. And I'm pleased to say that a couple generations later, I do not live with that kind of fear. And so I'm able to bring all different parts of my autobiography forward together with my science. That being said, I have obviously just immense appreciation for the ground that she broke.
Wow. Yeah. That's, I didn't know a lot of that. That's fascinating. And also slightly heartbreaking a little bit for Rachel, I feel.
It is, right? Because there is a public persona that is created about her that she helped create. right? Mm. Which presents her almost like a Rosa Parks-like figure, which we also who we also have a false impression of, I think, right? As a lone individual who spontaneously decided not to give up her seat on the bus, right? And we see Carson as kind of this lone scientist taking on the chemical industry with the beauty of her words, as if she had no life other than this kind of life of the lone biologist. And that she didn't. She had a rich, love-filled life with other women, and got a lot of assistance from women activists who were actually filing a lawsuit organized as a group called the Committee Against Mass Poisoning to try to stop aerial spraying of DDT. And they were sharing data with her that they had access to by virtue of the fact that there was power of discovery as part of this lawsuit, right? And so there were lots of, there's kind of a cast of thousands involved in Carson's work. But in order to be seen as a authoritative messenger of science in a time when women were not considered authoritative scientists, and especially not women who were not married to men, she had to create this kind of lone wolf figure that other people amplified too. But I'm interested in honoring her need to do that, but at the same time showing us the process by which Carson did her science and by which she did her creative writing.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit about that process as well. She didn't necessarily start out as a writer, right?
Did. I mean, that was her first love. So she was actually writing and publishing as a child and went off to college, which, coming from the kind of blue collar, desperately poor family that she did, wasn't something she was entitled to do. She felt very lucky to be able to go to this all women's college, and then discovered biology professors there who she just came to revere, these women scientists. And so she began to see that science would give her a lot to write about. But I would say she has the kind of soul of a writer first and foremost, and then these amazing skills as a scientist. And she seems to me to be equally proficient at both. It's not like she's a scientist who then realized she needed to convince the public of this message, so therefore she would try to write the best she can. Nor was she first and foremost a creative writer who just needed some subject matter and therefore discovered biology. She's really equally both things and is equally brilliant at both. And I think it's hard for those of us who are moving across disciplines to be recognized as two things rather than one thing. But I see her as someone who did both things very brilliantly.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because then one of the things I was maybe surprised isn't the right word, but taken by is the, I was thinking, you know, a science writer, you know, and someone who was writing about nature. I was expecting kind of a more academic style and voice to it, but it's really like descriptive and imaginative. Imagery is great in it. And it makes sense now, knowing that she, you know, was a, you know, writing first and, you know, a writer first.
Yeah,
and
then, right. It's like all the writerly, like her writing all has all the elements in it, right? There's a plot. There are actually characters that you care about, even if they're non-human characters. There are chase scenes. There are flashbacks. You know, there's metaphor and imagery. And in fact, you can actually scan her writing as you would a poem and discover metrical patterns in the writing. So when she wants to build up a sense of kind of reverence and dignity, I noticed that she uses iambic rhythm, which is a kind of a Shakespearean da-dum, 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 you know, and it gives a kind of solemnity to the writing. And then when she's trying to speed things up, like she's got a chase scene between two different organisms underwater, then she uses kind of this anapestic, like Edgar Allan Poe-like rhythm, da-da-dum, 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 right? And then when she wants to stop the scene and create suspense, she uses these things called trochees and spondees, which jam up the, slow you down, because it's a lot of accented syllables all on top of each other. And so I didn't know if she was doing that intentionally or not until I discovered some letters, I believe in the Beinecke Library, in which she's talking about her process. And explained that she would, you know, read things out loud to check for the rhythms. And then if she needed to change a two-syllable adjective to a one-syllable adjective to make it smoother, that she would do that. So she always complained that she wrote really slowly, as do I. So that made me feel better about my own writing.
There you go.
Because I think she has this kind of poet sensibility, right? She wanted the writing to be so beautiful that it, and she says this, you know, that she wanted the writing to honor the beauty that she saw in the natural world and make the writing really beautiful. So you may, as a reader, may not notice all the carpentry of writerly elements that she's using, all these literary devices, but they're definitely there.
Yeah, that's neat. And it makes me wonder too. I mean, you mentioned that sort of poetic sensibility. I'm curious if you can speak to how that sort of informed her, I guess, more harder scientific work, if that makes sense, and vice versa. Like, you know, did her writing impact, you know, how she researched and the world, yeah, and vice versa?
That's a really good question. I would say it's probably reciprocal for her, right? Mm-hmm. That they both influence and make the other better. So what impresses me so much about the Sea Trilogy books that, you know, are part of the new collection that I just edited for Library of America is that she was writing in the mid 20th century at a time before we had any visual pictures of what it looked like below the surface of the ocean. So all of us now, if we imagine, well, what does it look like down there? And the images we might come up with in our minds are probably something from a Nova special we saw, or Animal Kingdom, or some kind of, you know, cinematic underwater photography, right?
Right.
That didn't exist then. People, her readership had this incredible deep curiosity about the oceans because of World War II and all the submarine warfare and the use of radar. And so there was this great interest in what the ocean looked like below the sea. So in preparation to edit her work and write the introduction to this collection that Library of America so wonderfully offered me, like this absolute plum writing assignment, right? I began to look at what we knew about what it looked like down there when she was actually writing. It turns out not a lot. There were these bathyspheres, which were kind of primitive submarines that could be attached to, you know, some kind of tether, and they weren't self-propelled, and then lowered down from a ship. And then some of them had little windows that then the researchers could kind of look out, but they didn't really, you know, take moving pictures. There weren't low light cameras yet to do that kind of work. And right. So then there were, you know, the Alvin submarine, which is still out there doing research. That didn't launch until kind of the, I think 1962 or something like that, from Cape Cod. And so so she was writing at a time when she was in touch with the people that went down in these submarines, but they couldn't go that deep. They didn't go like into the Mariana Trench or any of the deep sea things. So, okay. So essentially that's all a prelude for me saying that she figured out what it looked like down there as a scientist who worked at in the Woods Hole Oceanographic, you know, the research facility on Cape Cod. And then, you know, they would go out on ships and then use giant sort of grabbers to tongs to kind of haul stuff up from the bottom and then look at these organisms on the surface of the earth. And then by figuring out like how their jaws were located, what their flippers and their coloration was, figure out what they must be eating, how they must be finding mates, how they move through the water. And so she used her knowledge of anatomy and physiology to then recreate using creative writing, using sentences and words to create a visual picture for us about how these creatures interacted with each other and created a community underwater far from human life. But she went further than that and explained about her process to her publisher that she intended to kind of dehumanize her readers. So rather than like a lot of sea writing, which is written almost all by up to Carson by men, they always put themselves in the story, right? They were the big hero of their own story, the seagoer, you know, the Ahabs. And so she wanted no human beings. She wanted her readers to have a feeling that they were the fish, right? Mm-hmm. So she puts you in the body of the fish and makes you feel the vibrations in the water, the columns of water, the changing temperatures that would give you information that would be very different information than we get here on the sunlit kind of terrestrial surface of the earth. And she used all her knowledge of biology to create the language that becomes essentially language functions for her in these sea trilogies, I argue, as a kind of underwater camera in this very cinematic way. So the reader is taken on a Nova style journey, but through language, because there weren't, you know, there just wasn't cinematography to show us yet. And then when that cinematography right. came in years later, lo and behold, Rachel Carson's writing is the actual like transcript of what we see in Nova. So I just came to appreciate how she was able to start with very fine details of the structure of a jaw of a fish and then create this whole world for us.
Yeah, it's very impressive too. And a great combination of both those, like we've been talking about, both those sides of her, you know, the scientific and the more artistic. Since you mentioned the Sea Trilogy, I want to talk about that a little bit too. It's three books, right? Obviously it's a trilogy, but the collection has all three in them, I meant to say. Curious what your sort of process was in editing that.
So let me back up and just say a little bit about Library of America, because it doesn't sort of make sense unless you understand this kind of one amazing publishing house. So Library of America is a nonprofit press whose kind of self-appointed mission is to canonize the work of classic American writers in volumes that are considered permanent. And that actually is a word that has meaning in to archivists and bookmakers. And so a permanent book has to be produced on a certain kind of paper that it won't disintegrate over time, with a certain kind of binding that, you know, that is sewn together and won't fall apart, with certain kinds of ink and so forth. And so each Library of America book is a beautiful object. And in this case, the Sea Trilogy binds together three different Rachel Carson wrote three ocean books, and it collects them all together. And those are Under the Sea Wind, which she published, unfortunately, right before the attack on Pearl Harbor. And then that, it didn't sell at all, because suddenly we were at war and no one was interested in a lyrical book on the ocean. But then when her big Sea Around Us came out in 1955, then this her earlier book, Under the Sea Wind, they both became bestsellers. And then finally, The Edge of the Sea, which she wrote about the liminal zone between the shoreline and the ocean. That's the kind of the part of the ocean we know the best if we've ever been to a beach, right? So she describes that to us and shows it us to it in new eyes. So all three of those books are collected together. So you might imagine that this book would be like unwieldy and huge and hard to even hold, because it's three big books all together. And it is, in fact, it's like 700 and some pages, but Library of America is so adroit at creating books with very thin pages. So it's not heavy. And it's not really, it's a little chubby thing, but it's not really hard to hold it. I actually weighed it on my kitchen scale. It's like it's a little over a pound. And yet, even though the pages are very thin and sleek, you can't see the shadow of the ink, you know, when it doesn't bother you when you turn the page. I don't know how they do it. Anyway, I just want to put in a plug for the beauty of these books. All right. So I was asked then to edit this collection, which is endowed, which means that this book will never go out of print. It has an endowment to keep it in print forevermore. And this is considered now the definitive edition of Rachel Carson. So all the editors at Library of America behind the scenes, and I did not have to do this part of it, scour through all of the earlier editions and correct any typos or any mistakes so that scholars can treat this as the definitive edition now of her work. And it will never, never go out of print. So that's just kind of an amazing thing. So I just want to say that because I am still absolutely humbled and honored that I was asked to be the editor of this collection, which meant I got to write the introduction to it and be part of, you know, how this was being put together. And it was just an incredible labor of love. So with that, go ahead and ask me your question again, I guess.
Well, I was just curious what the, you know, process was in editing, you know, three books. And then, I mean, I know you wrote the introduction, which I read, I think, at least a part of it on LitHub the other day, which was great. I wasn't sure if it was the full thing or at least a part of it, but
it's a part of it. Yeah. And so, well, that was most of my responsibility since I had this amazing staff of other people to do the kind of real hard, tedious work of, you know, correcting anything that needed to be corrected and assembling the pieces in a certain order. So there, you know, as in any kind of collection, there's a whole set of glossy photos. There are all the footnotes. And then we did choose to include some writings that Carson did about the sea prior to writing these book length forms. So you can see the evolution of her writing style. And then we also chose to include the second edition of The Sea Around Us rather than the first edition. And that's because in the first edition, Carson made the case in the early 50s that the ocean was inviolate, and that was one of the things that attracted her to the sea, that it was so large and so beyond the tamperings of man, as was the language of the day, right? That we could look at the sea as and understand that this was a pure biological thing. This was creation itself. This was where life began. And because the ocean is downstream from everything else on the earth, it's where everything ends up. It's the beginning and the end. So there's something very biblical about that second book, The Sea Around Us. But in between, after she released it, she became aware, because she remembers she was a biologist for fish and wildlife. So she actually had access in some cases to classified documents. And she was aware of about above ground nuclear testing and the dumping of radioactive waste into the deep part of the ocean, and the way that that radioactivity wasn't just disappearing or being diluted by the vastness of the ocean. In fact, it was being siphoned up the food chain and concentrated, and it was eternal. The ocean had been eternally changed by the actions of human beings who had used and deployed nuclear weapons, right? And so when she wrote the second edition, she, in a way that's very unusual for scientists, made a big mea culpa and corrected herself in the opening pages to say, the reason for the second edition is that my worldview has changed. I now see that the oceans are vulnerable and that they are not beyond our reach. In fact, they've been damaged by our actions collectively as a species. And therefore, any account of the ocean would be incomplete if I did not weave that story into the story of the sea and its ongoing creation and decreation. And we found that bit fascinating that Carson did that. And so part of what I felt that I wanted to do in re-releasing her work and under the imprimatur of Library of America is kind of scatter some breadcrumbs to help readers move from mid-20th century oceanography and what our understanding was with this kind of bombshell awakening that human beings and certain institutions like our military or like the chemical industry could destroy whole ecosystems, right? That was something that Carson was one of the first scientists to awaken to and then write about, that we wanted to include that second edition as part of this, because what I wanted to do was lay these breadcrumbs to show readers of her work the path between what we knew in the mid 20th century and the climate crisis that we're facing today. And because I believe it really started with that second book in the trilogy, The Sea Around Us. In fact, Carson has a whole chapter in The Sea Around Us called The Global Thermostat, which is about the way the ocean actually regulates our climate system. And she was able to see the first signs of climate change using her powers of observation as a scientist and the kind of intuitive, inductive thinking as a poet and a writer to see how that was happening. She did not have a working understanding, as we do now, of how greenhouse gases actually trap heat. So we understand now that certain molecules like carbon dioxide and methane are actually have chemical bonds, which will start to vibrate when reflected heat from the earth, so-called thermal radiation, strikes them, they'll start to vibrate. And it's that molecular vibration, that's what we're talking about when we say greenhouse gases are heat-trapping gases. They have the power to trap heat. So rather than reflected light from the sun being radiated back into outer space, it's trapped because it starts all these molecules dancing in our in environment, right? And thanks to carbon dioxide and methane, our Earth's atmosphere has a kind of blanket around it, which prevents us from freezing to death at night because it traps heat for us. Carson understood that. What she didn't quite put together, and I don't blame her for this, because we didn't have, we weren't monitoring levels of carbon dioxide and methane yet. That actually started a few years after her death. What she couldn't see is that by burning fossil fuels, we were loading up the atmosphere. Now we have, you know, three times as much methane, 30 to 40% more carbon dioxide. So that blanket of vibrating molecules is just getting thicker and thicker. And now it's starting to destabilize the whole climate system. She was seeing the first signs of that, but didn't have a working understanding of the cause of it. So I sort of see her like a Charles Darwin figure who saw that that evolution happened by natural selection, but didn't have a working understanding of genes yet, right? We didn't know about genes and DNA yet, but somehow managed to figure it out anyway. And so there's Carson figuring out that the climate is warming and warning us about it. In 1955, without really having the ability, because we weren't monitoring concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, to really know what was driving it. It's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's, again, another impressive aspect of to be able to, I don't know, in, with most things, there needs to be a little bit of imagination, and science is no different, right? You know, she could imagine this, and then later, you know, with more... I'm guessing better equipment and more just documenting those levels, then it again, once again, it's like, oh, Rachel Carson was right.
Rachel Carson was right. Yeah. And she imagined it. And then because she couldn't, you know, didn't have access to, as we do now, long-term trends of greenhouse gases in the environment, in the atmosphere, instead, what she did was look, she saw the way the ocean stabilized the climate and had enough of a working understanding to start looking at ice melting of glaciers and icebergs. And so she was indirectly able to put that together. I'll just read like two sentences from her. And this, again, is from the chapter called The Global Thermostat from the Sea Around Us. So, and you have to remember, again, this is 1955, right? So this is more than, like, older than I am now, and I'm 62. So she writes, but for the present, the evidence that the top of the world is growing warmer is to be found on every hand. The recession of the northern glaciers is going on at such a rate that many smaller ones have already disappeared. If the present rate of melting continues, others will soon follow. And she was right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. that kind of, one of my questions I had, you kind of answered already, but it's kind of, I guess, why the Sea trilogy and why now?
Well, for me, I mean, I guess Library of America and me as a scientist might give you two different answers, right? So I'll try to represent both. So Library of America, to its credit, sees Rachel Carson as belonging to the pantheon of classic American authors that it canonizes. And I might say that she should have been part of that pantheon a long time ago, right? But I'm glad she's now there. And so that means in 2018, I was first asked to edit the first of the two collections that Library of America has put out, which is Silent Spring and her other environmental writings. So that came that we Library of America released that one first, even though that's her was her final book. And that's probably the one she's most well known for, right? Her, like, she's taking on the chemical industry directly and making a case for these inherently toxic poisons that are being introduced without our consent. She saw it as a human rights issue and wrote very powerfully about that in Silent Spring. And then pretty quickly after that, about 18 months later, died of breast cancer, shortly after testifying in front of, you know, before Congress. So that's what we kind of know her for. But before that, she had this long history of writing these three ocean books for which she was a best-selling author. So in her lifetime, she was more well-known as this chronicler of the sea. So I'm very lucky to have been asked to edit both collections, the 2018 environmental writings of Rachel Carson, and then more recently, just the just-released Sea Trilogy. So this now represents the entire body of her work. And in both cases, we include in these two collections some of the letters, the speeches, the earlier writing that appeared in magazines where you see her kind of working out the science and working out her metaphors and imagery. And then they're like sketches, right, toward these big magnum opus collections that she worked so many years on. And so this is as close as we have these two volumes, I would say, to the complete works of Rachel Carson. And I would say she more than deserves to be, you know, brought into the stable of the authors that Library of America uplifts and holds up as representative of American letters.
Yeah, no, I mean, I couldn't agree more. She's featured a few times throughout our museum as well, in a similar sense. And I mean, speaking of writing, I guess to nerd out a little bit, if you will, what sort of, you mentioned kind of her evolution as a writer by looking at those early magazine pieces. If you could, I guess, maybe characterize that a little bit, like, you know, as a writer, how did she sort of start out? And then how did her voice and style develop through the years?
Right. Well, I guess it's important to say that she was always desperate for money. And so some of the writing happened because she just needed the check. And I think it's good to be really honest about that, right?
Yeah.
Because she didn't have enough money to get her PhD. She was kind of thwarted in doing that. I mean, she probably could have, but she had this whole extended family to support. So her father never really made much of a good living. And then he died. And then there were siblings she had who had children that they couldn't support. One of them, she actually adopted near the end of her life, her grandnephew. But the point is that she always had this big extended family for which she was the sole breadwinner. So even when she was in Washington, D.C. and rising through the ranks of the Fish and Wildlife Service as a biologist in charge of kind of technical publications, she was hungry to have side gigs and make more cash. And so one of the technical, she wrote an essay that was supposed to be part of a catalog. And her boss kind of very lovingly told her it was unacceptable because it was just too beautiful of a piece of writing. So she had to redo it and just make it drier and technical to sort of meet the format of, you know, the government. But he was taken enough with it that he said, you really should submit this to a magazine. How about, you know, The Atlantic? And so she did, and then got it published. And but you can see from her, the writings, the private writings that she was doing, that she, like, oh, well, so my boss told me I should submit this, but, you know, maybe I can make some money, you know, that kind of thing. So so she did it for those, to support this large extended family she had. and then had success and realized that that she could become an author. And so was kind of for a while, like scientist by day, author by night, really burning the candles at both ends. And then when the second book, Under the Sea, When the Sea Around Us became so wildly successful, I mean, it's hard to overstate what a sort of publishing juggernaut that was, right? It just rocketed to the top of the bestseller list and just stayed there. And so that allowed her actually to quit her day job and then write full time. And you can kind of see through some of these memos and letters and speeches that we've collected, you can see her identity as an author and as a public intellectual kind of take shape, right? But it was, if there was ever an American story about someone rising from their own merit, it would have to be, I would say, Rachel Carson. She had like no inside connections at all.
Yeah,
she was just doing this because she was just an astonishing scientist on the one hand, an astonishing writer on the other. And she happened to fall in love with the topic, the sea, that there was this immense public curiosity about in the middle of the 20th century because of submarines and World War II. So like all the stars aligned in this kind of amazing way. Yeah.
Yeah, that is amazing. And quite the, you don't hear too often something getting rejected because it's too good. Or I guess it wasn't rejected.
Right, that's it. That's what happens.
Yeah, your writing's too good for that press. Since we are, the American Writers Museum, we always like to look at a writer's influences, and kind of trace a literary lineage, if you will. Do you know if Rachel Carson had any writers that she looked up to or liked to read?
You know, I've been thinking about that, and I would say she's pretty self-made. I don't think there were models for what she was trying to do. And I'm willing to be wrong about this, but I see her as kind of cut from whole cloth and kind of de novo doing this. So I don't see her emulating or talking in her letters or in her writings to other people about other science writers. I don't see her comparing herself to anyone. I would say that maybe we get some hints as based on who she decides to quote, and who are in the epigraphs, right? So in Silent Spring, it's E.B. White, who is at the time writing for the New Yorker, which she aspired very much to be a writer in too, and in fact. Silent Spring was excerpted in the New Yorker, one third of the whole book for three issues in a row. Can you imagine that as an author having a third of your book before its publication date excerpted in the New Yorker or three issues in a row? So she quotes E.B. White, she quotes Keats, and she quotes French philosophers and other writers about the reverence of life and this ethos that essentially what we love, we must protect, right? That we have a right to know, and out of that right to know flows an obligation to take action. So she quotes different philosophical and ethical writers on those topics. So I think those are the writers she was looking toward. I don't see her quoting or referencing a lot of other scientists or scientific writers. And in fact, in some of her letters to her beloved Dorothy, she's openly disparaging of some of the scientists that she knows have data on the evidence showing that pesticides are harming wildlife or creating human health risks, but who are too afraid to speak openly about it or even share their data with her. Because she, was writing to all the scientists who might have evidence for this so she could compile it for Silent Spring. And she was very impatient with the scientists who were top of their field scientists, but were too afraid to speak. She felt if you were so privileged to be a scientist, you had an obligation. That was a big word for her, obligation, right? So she actually wrote to her beloved Dorothy a private letter explaining how she thought of these guys as cowards. And she even quoted, and she thought she was quoting Abraham Lincoln. It turns out it wasn't a quote from Lincoln, but she said she liked this quote a lot. It seemed to, like, if Carson had a motto, this would be it. And it was this, to sin by silence when they should protest makes cowards out of men. And she was specifically speaking about these scientists who had the data, but wouldn't bring it forward to warn the public or bring it, you know, to the legislature, to political leaders for redress of grievance and for change of policy, because they just wanted, you know, to keep their grants flowing, keep their head down. So I think she saw herself as actually very courageous. She had a pretty high opinion of herself, even though her public persona was like the shy, retiring Rachel Carson, right? So, and I'm really glad of that. I'm really glad to know that she had this sort of like, I'm right, I have the data. These guys are cowards. And I'm gonna like go out and prove them wrong and win all these awards. It's very nice to see that side of her. And so I'm glad we had a chance to collect some of those letters that shows her self-confidence and her, you know, like informed by the data. But once she pieced it all together, she felt like, okay, I have a really powerful case to make and I'm morally obligated to make it.
Yeah, that's a, you said it was a big word for obligation. That is a, I think both in the terms of, you know, the science side of it, and then also the, you know, I feel like writers have an obligation to speak the truth, or their truths at least, and write to that. And she seems to be right up that alley as well.
She sure is. Yeah. And also as scientists, you know, why do we want to understand the world? It's to make it better, right? It's not just to say, wow, photosynthesis is so cool, right? It's like, if I, as a biologist, now understand that half of the oxygen that we breathe comes from plankton, which is the case, and that plankton are now in trouble in the ocean because of warming temperatures, changing currents that disallow the sort of fish poop that is the nitrogen fertilizer for the planktons to grow and flourish. If that's all being disrupted, then our oxygen supply is being affected, right? So I, as a scientist, have an obligation to find a language to talk about that problem to the public. And so I go back to Carson all the time to get ideas. She's a model for me, but also a counter model, because I feel like I can talk about myself and my own identity as a mother, as a gay woman, as a cancer survivor, and remind people that behind every data point is a human life, right? And so that was a story that she couldn't really tell, right? So I have more writerly tools than she was, just because the space has opened in our culture for me to be not white, straight, male, rich, which is what most scientists used to be.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I guess that does kind of answer my question. It was going to, you know, what Rachel Carson, you know, as a person and scientist and writer, but also as just a person, what she means to you personally, and how, you know, how her work has influenced your life and work as well.
Well, so, I mean, it's hard to overstate, right? I think for all ecologists, not just me, but for all of us, Carson opened a space and provoked a curiosity in the public that's still there, a kind of hunger for understanding how the natural world functions and what our role in it is. And so she created such beautiful language that she was able to spark a whole environmental movement dedicated to the protection and further understanding of this world, you know, and the idea that we're not part, there's not the environment and then us as a separate compartment, that we there's a communion between us and the environment that we live in, and it's a reciprocal communion, right? So just to go back to the plankton for a minute, with every breath we take, we breathe in a pint of atmosphere. So I'm talking to you now, and my speech is enabled by the fact that 2 pints of atmosphere are going into my lungs. And in that 2 pints, 20% of that is oxygen, which is given to me. Half of that is given to me by the world's plankton, and the other half by the world's trees, right? So half of the oxygen on Earth is from terrestrial plants, the other half, probably a little more than half, of from marine plankton. And so my life is enabled by these other creatures, so I'm entirely dependent on them. And so similarly, I'm also part of the food chain. I'm 65% water by weight, so I am full of raindrops, you know, and I am part of the food chain. And then I do things that in turn affect the food chains and affect the water cycles, because I'm part of economies and I'm part of food systems and agricultural systems. And so Carson was interested in explicating for us this two-way communion between our bodies and our lives and the world that we're embedded within within us, because deep in my chest wall are the molecules that brought to me by plankton and trees, right? And we breathe out carbon dioxide, and that carbon dioxide that I'm exhaling gets taken up through the stomata of a leaf and is spun in a chloroplast into sugar through the miracle of photosynthesis and through that whole opera of what goes on within chloroplast. And so the plants and animals are in this interdependent relationship. And she celebrated that and was reverent about it, even as she actually explicated and showed us the kind of chemical machinery that actually made it all run. But she believed, as do I, that understanding the sort of chemistry and physics and biology of how it all works doesn't take away from the mystery or the reverence, but it actually deepens it, especially if you can write about it in really beautiful ways and then have a curiosity about it. So her whole theory of social change was that if you could inculcate in readers a sense of reverence for life, that would push away the lust for destruction. I actually think she's wrong about that. I mean, it's a beautiful idea and it kind of works, but I think we're at a point now that is a different moment in time than the one in which Carson lived, in which her problem was being taken seriously as a messenger of science. But science itself was occupied an exalted place in our culture in the mid-20th century. I mean, even as evidenced by the fact that we called artificial breast milk formula, and we marketed it as formula. We still call it that now, right? But that was a mid-20th century invention that capitalized and marketed the idea that a chemical formula was superior to anything that a woman's body could make, because we held up science as this great thing, right? So her problem was that she was not seen as, she was this, you know, unmarried spinster, which was a kind of code for possibly gay woman. And she was not going to be allowed to represent the voice of science. My problem is different. My problem is that in the year 2021, year of our Lord, science itself is no longer considered, it's up for debate. It's like, right? We're just liberal elitists and we don't have to, you know, we're not only denying the science of the climate crisis, we're already denying like germ theory, right? I mean, anti-vaccination is rampant. Right. And so it's science itself that's no longer occupies the same place. And books, I would say, don't occupy the same. When Silent Spring was published in 1962, I was only 3 years old, but I remember that book as this toddler, even though I couldn't even read the cover of it, because every adult was carrying around a copy, including my own father, who was very conservative, you know, 100% Republican voting guy who taught high school and was actually using it as a course text in his consumer education class. So my first memory of Rachel Carson is my dad taking this book out of his briefcase after he would come home from teaching high school every day. And it was a green cover. And I just, you know, and I saw that cover being carried around by many adults, including like the bus driver would have had a copy tucked in the front of the bus. That when my mom and I would take the bus into town. And so I came to feel it must be really, Rachel Carson must be really important because everyone is reading her book. I don't think books occupy that space in the culture anymore, right? So and I have a different theory of social change, and it has a lot to do with the need to build political power and grassroots citizen movements and do civil disobedience and things like that, that having a reverence for life in and of itself is just not going to prevent planetary destruction.
Yeah, right. It's like it just needs to be taken to the next level
Yeah, we need to dismantle the fossil fuel industry. That just has to happen, right?
Right.
Yeah. And that's, and the fossil fuel industry has captured our government agencies, has captured elected leaders in Congress, and that all has to be taken apart. And so I have actually myself, first inspired by Rachel Carson, but then responding to the facts on the ground as they are now, have resigned from academia. I'm no longer an academic biologist, and I'm now serving the world as a senior scientist for the Science and Environmental Health Network, which is a think tank. But more specifically, we provide good science and legal resources to communities who are on the front lines of fighting the oil and gas extraction industry.
Okay.
Well, we're doing science for the people. So I'm, we're in a terrible crisis now. We have a very limited number of years before us, before we hit these unfixable tipping points, beyond which, no matter how rapidly we decarbonize, we can't bring it back, right? We're living in a very different world, a world with no pollinators, for example, which would be disastrous. And so I, responding to that crisis, as so many scientists are, I'm no longer interested in generating more data. I mean, more data is always a good and wonderful thing. But to me, at this moment in human history, what's more important is to take the knowledge we already have and act on it and help people look at that knowledge and not feel despair, but feel empowered to take action. So I'm interested in writing to my readers stories of courageous action and making people feel that you don't want to be a good German right now. You don't want to pretend you don't see. You want to live your life in a heroic way. And it's really time for the oil and gas industry to exit our economy. We have different solutions, and they're really innovative and they're very exciting. And let's all be part of this. Let's all do something different, right? So I'm really interested in a different kind of writing than Carson was. But that's because I live in a different moment in history. And yet I'm taking the lessons and the techniques that she has given me and then kind of shape them for the new situation we find ourselves in.
Yeah. As you were saying that, it reminded me of earlier, we were talking about Rachel Carson being upset and ticked off by the scientists who had all the data already, but they just weren't doing anything with it. This is a question I ask on every episode of this, and I'm especially interested for this one. It's given that we are in such a climate crisis and, you know, have been for a while, but attacks on science in general that are happening and are trying to discredit science, I guess. And how do you think Rachel Carson would be interacting and engaging with this world if she were alive in 2021?
Well, I would like to think that she would be a big admirer of this little shop I am now working under, the Science and Environmental Health Network, because we have very intentionally taken her lessons, taken the Carsonettes worldview, especially that word obligation, that once you know, you have an obligation to act, and created sort of actionable knowledge to citizens who are organizing in their communities to fight pipelines, to close down power plants, to fight certain toxic facilities, ban fracking. So we're providing the scientific tools so that people feel informed to stand up and give testimony in their state house, you know, at their house of worship, before their city council. And I feel like Science and Environmental Health Network is doing a great job doing that. And our founder and executive director, Carolyn Raffensperger, who is an environmental attorney by training and a great admirer of Carson, imagine what an institution, a nonprofit institution, could be like if we took Carson's ideas and brought together some of the best scientists and the best attorneys to make policy ideas and to create the kind of world that Carson had in mind. So it's a way of us continuing her work. So I feel really lucky to now have that be my day job, to work with that group of people. And I also see, as did Carson at the end of her life, that science and law really belong together, right? So that the law, meaning our sort of policies, should reflect the state of the science and should be responsive to them. And in the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years, our policies have become our death to the new findings of science. So we're we don't have an energy system that responds to the findings of climate science. We just keep on, you know, shoveling fossil fuels into ovens and lighting them on fire and loading up the atmosphere with more heat trapping gases as if we didn't know, right?
Right.
And so in my way of thinking, like, science is like a bunch of thread. It's all, you know, all the data is just a kind of pile of thread, and the law is like a needle. And if you thread the thread into the needle, you can create an embroidery, right? A picture of what you want the world to look like. And Carson was very big on looking at this as a human rights issue, as do we in Science and Environmental Health Network, that she talked a lot about that if the right to a safe environment wasn't enshrined in the Constitution, it's only because our forefathers couldn't foresee a day when toxic poisons and terribly environmentally destructive practices would harm health and harm babies, you know, even prenatal, during prenatal life. And that our future generations would not forgive us for dashing poisons against the life support systems that they will depend on. And so we at Environmental Health Network take that really that charge really seriously. So we want to reimagine what policy would look like that honored the ways that the interdependence of all life forms, like what would our economy look like? What would our educational system look like? How would we get source drinking water? How would we turn the lights on if sustaining life were the kind of first principle here? So yeah. I would like to think that Carson would be proud that there's a small group of us who have taken her ethos and tried to sort of make it so, right? To try to enact it, and in fact are doing good work in ways that we really are helping communities shut things down. I mean, it's hugely gratifying to me to put together, and right now I'm working a lot on this form of energy extraction called fracking, and put together everything we know from the scientific literature and the risks and harms of fracking. Write about it in a way that can be understood easily, that it isn't technical. Get it out of the sort of obscure peer-reviewed journals, and then offer it to people who are actually fighting fracking in their communities. And sometimes we win. Sometimes, you know, we actually something I've written helps a community shut down a really harmful thing. And I've managed to do it in my own community. Played a role in shutting down an Eisenhower era coal burning power plant that was one of the biggest polluters in our community, and helped do that with some really good science, but also a lot of grassroots power. So for me, the kind of, if it's a David and Goliath fight, you know, David has a slingshot and the slingshot is made out of science, grassroots political power, but also love. And of those things, Carson had love and science. She didn't really have a working knowledge of grassroots political power. She just didn't kind of operate that way. But I think that's how social change happens. So I'm in that kind of field, right?
Yeah.
And there's nothing that makes me happier than going down to the edge of the lake I live along, which is Cayuga Lake, and looking across to the east bank and seeing that coal burning power plant that is no longer emitting, right? So I can look at the sky above the stack and there's nothing coming out of that after so many years of polluting us. And I used to swim down there when I was pregnant with my son, knowing that those emissions were going into my body, into my son's body. And now that we stopped that, and I couldn't have done that with science alone. It took science informing an entire community, and that entire community fighting for years and years, and then we did it.
Yeah, that's very well said. I think she too would be very proud of you, and honestly, right there with you on the front lines. So we're getting close to wrapping up. Did you have? I know you shared a little bit of her writing earlier. Do you have any favorite quotes or passages.
I want to let's let Carson have the last word here. Something kind of playful. So because we think playful, of her her as, you know, so serious and earnest, right? And she certainly was and had to be, because she had to be taken seriously as a scientist. But in her last book, The Edge of the Sea, she dedicated it to her beloved Dorothy. That's who it's devoted to. And Dorothy was actually a married woman, so she also dedicated the book to Dorothy's husband. But it starts with this, in the first chapter, which is called The Marginal World, Carson does something she hasn't ever done before in her writing, which is break into the first person and guide us into this very intimate space, which I think is frankly sexual. And I think she's being very playful here and sending a little like fairy dust message to Dorothy. That's my read of this. So she's going into this pool filled cave that's accessible only at the lowest of the year's low tides. So she says, and so I knelt on the wet carpet of sea moss and looked back into the dark cavern that held the pool in a shallow basin. The floor of the cave was only a few inches below the roof, and a mirror had been created in which all that grew on the ceiling was reflected in the still water below. In the moment when I looked into the cave, a little elfin starfish hung down, suspended by the merest thread. The beauty of the reflected images and of the limpid pool itself was the poignant beauty of things that are ephemeral, existing only until the sea should return to fill the little cave. Whenever I go down into this magical zone of the low water of the spring's tides, I look for the most delicately beautiful of all the shore's inhabitants, flowers that are not plant but animal, blooming out on the threshold of the deeper sea, merely waiting in that moment of the tides ebbing for the return of the sea, then in the rush of water, in the surge of the surf and the pressure of the incoming tide, the delicate flower heads would stir with life, sway on their slender stalks, and their long tentacles would sweep the returning water, finding in it all that they needed for life. And so in that enchanted place, on the threshold of the sea, the realities that possessed my mind were far from those of the land world that I had left behind an hour before. So however you want to read that, whether it's a coded sexual message or not, clearly she is playing with the idea that there's a sensuousness in nature, that we can, our lives can be kind of transformed, even in, it, not in these kind of big epic ways like in sea voyages, but merely finding these small creatures on the shoreline. And so the kind of transportive epiphany and ethereal, transcendental, like she's not afraid to talk about the importance of us having these emotive experiences in nature. And then, you know, a chapter later, she's going to be all serious biologist again. But there's that little playful part of her that I just love at the beginning of the book.
Yeah, that was great. That was, yeah, beautiful. Thanks for sharing that part. I want to thank you again for joining me on this. I had a great conversation. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about that we didn't cover?
No, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for having me on the program, Nate.
Yeah, thank you. And again, the book is Sea Trilogy. It's out now, right?
It is.
Yes. Yeah. So if you're listening, go out and grab it and learn a little bit more about Rachel Carson. Dr. Steingraber, thanks again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers, their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.